dreamed of becoming a famous animator, and when he finally made it, he thought that Disney didn't do good work. So he asked his good friend Gary to help him start a studio.
Welcome to the Gospel Bluth. That's right, folks. I am somehow still here, and this is what's happening. It's the very last Don fucking Bluth movie that we are doing, and it's been a long time coming. I needed to be free of this man, and he's been haunting me, this Midwestern Mormon with a real penchant for Christ children and sexy animals. He's been haunting me in my sleep, and I need to be done with him, but I've got great news, and it's that it's finally happening. And today, to help me chat about just how lucky we are to be finished with Don Bluth and his film Titan A.E. That's right, folks, we're talking about Titan A.E. I've got two wonderful guests with me. I'm going to introduce Ray Chalmay, who is the once and future New Jerseyan and temporary West Virginian, who's currently making ambient drone music as Warm Tape. How are you, Ray?
I'm doing so well. It's great to be here. This is a long time coming, I think. The Bluth Cinematic Universe comes to a close. I'm here for it. Like, let's go.
Yeah, it's a long time coming. You said it. Oh boy, I can't wait. And now I'm so excited. My stomach hurts. My next guest. Wow, what a legend, folks! It's Dan Chamberlain from The Tonight Show, a writer.
Wow.
Of The Tonight Show. How are you, Dan?
I am well. It's to watch a movie like this so close to the holidays is really, really just warms the heart.
Right. At the end of the day, it's about community and, home.
And defeating the dredge.
Defeating the dredge. My gosh. And, you know, I'm so glad you brought up the Dredge, because somebody's got to talk about the Dredge. Somebody.
The Dredge, like, could not exist without, like, Blue Dabadee, I think. Like, that's kind of, like, the hill that I'm dying on. It's like Eiffel 65 walked so Don Bluth could run in this instance. Like, I'm just loving that coursing blue energy. You know, late 90s were a trip.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the Dredge had big Power Ranger putty energy to me. Mm. And we're introduced to the Dredge so fast in this movie that what threw me for a loop is, so Fight Night, if this movie came out in 2000, I think we like to think of like post 9/11 as where like it's like really like awful, like vile jingoism like sprang to life in America. But you see like the seeds of it here well before the events of September 11th with this like, you know, generic faceless others, you know, that are just where they're introduced as enemies who are jealous of us and they want what we have.
Yeah,
and that's all we ever need to know about.
They're scared of what we could become, which is never like fully explained or like given a real like danger, like level. Just like, what can we become? What are you so afraid of? Just
I think they're afraid of us using their bodies to power rocket ships, and guess what? They were right to be afraid,
folks. Not to spoil it, but we did. The movie does almost end in like a genocide. Can we like confirm that? Can we agree on that? The movie does end with the genocide of the Dredge.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so you're turning it on its side here, because I kind of thought you were saying, you know, humanity maybe, but like you're concerned with the plight of the Dredge in this scenario.
Well, I'm just saying that, you know, I know that the Dredge were trying to destroy all humanity, and then at the end of the day, humanity destroys the Dredge. So my whole thing is, you know, it's a snake eating its own tail, folks. Violence begets violence.
But, you know, out of the gate, one of the first things that jumped out to me in this introduction of the Dredge is, you know, it's such like a storytelling thing of like, hey, show, don't tell, right? And in many ways, this movie neither shows nor tells the logic of like, you know, I feel like it's like a cliche of like quote unquote bad sci-fi to begin with, like the text crawl that explains, you know, hey, it's the year 3035 and, you know, humanity is endangered species and that sort of thing. This movie doesn't bother with that. So you're definitely guessing as to what is going on and where you are and what the rules of this world are for a good, 70 to 80 minutes of a 90-minute running time.
Yeah, this, are you familiar with the Sharpling and Worcester, you know, the gas station dogs where they kind of, you know, rock and roll dreams will come through. It's a track where like 19 different characters are introduced in the span of like 3 minutes, and like it just kind of feels like the vernacular introduction of, like, in this movie is just like, all right, here's all of these species you have to know, here are a bunch of names, you don't know which are going to be relevant in the next 5 minutes, you don't know who's going to come back, and it is just like whiplash inducing. It's kind of a nightmare. And like, full disclosure, like, I have not watched a ton of Bluth. I don't know, is it, it's all pretty much like this, right? Like, they just kind of swap the characters?
Oh, I'm going to tell you all about my good friend Don, because he's a mess. So I'm really glad you bring this up, Ray. Real quick, I want to go through the plot, because I think it's important for us to talk about, or to address what plot there is, which is very there's minimal plot, I would say. It's pretty straightforward. So yeah, we start in the year 3028. There is a groundbreaking scientific project called the Titan Project, and it makes the Dredge, which are a hostile race of aliens with bodies of pure energy, really upset, and they fear that humans will quote unquote challenge them. They're afraid of what the humans.
Now, we don't know what the Titan Project is.
We have no idea. We just know that at the start of the movie, Kale, who is later played by whose adult form is played by Matt Damon, is playing in a river, and then suddenly his dad, played by Ron Perlman, is scooping him up and being like, you gotta go, the dredge are here. Also, I gotta stay because the Titan is, I gotta fix the Titan.
Can we take a moment to just shout out Alex D. Linz of Max Keeble fame as Baby Kale? I don't want any erasure here.
Also, a young Francis Dolarhyde in Red Dragon, who gets horribly abused by his grandmother and ends up becoming a serial killer with that with the mouthpiece there.
You can really see the progression from role to role.
You can hear him eating a Francis Bacon painting on the.
Don only gets the heavy hitters. He only gets the real talents to play his children.
Well, Linz was available? Shit.
get him in here. Get him in the booth. Linz kills it. Linz kills it. I'll tell you know, for like the 5 minutes. Although I will say there's like the one part that I didn't understand of the dialogue where like young Kale is being picked up by Tech and like carried to the ship, and Ron Perlman's dad is like, hey, I hope this is okay, but I gotta go. And then young Kale is like, it's okay. And then Tech picks him up and goes, it's not okay. Like, I don't know. You just said it's okay. You gotta live with that shit. Maybe I'm just too mean, but
Tech, who is voiced by Tone Loke, of course, Lou the Guana from Fern Gully, and actually, but has a pretty good voiceover career for a rapper in the early '90s. Anyways, he was sort of one of the first guys to break out and do that. The appearance of Tone Loke as Tech is the first instance of many in this movie that calls to mind. Different, better movies that make you wish you were watching a different, better movie, which kind of happened time and again throughout this movie for me. They're like, hey, it was Tone Loke. Oh, yeah, he was the iguana in Fern Gully. Boy, Fern Gully was fun. What if we watched that instead?
To your point, I was actually going to say Tech kind of has, for the Phantom Menace heads who are listening, Tech kind of has Sebulba energy, but like slightly more anti-Semitic caricature, like version of Sebulba, which I didn't know was possible. Like, I feel like these characters probably come from the same universe, and it's a universe that like loves Ben Garrison.
Yeah. I mean, I could go on and on about the deeply problematic characters found in Don Bluth movies. But to get the full scoop, folks, listen to episodes 1 through, fuck, how many have I done of this? 9? Yeah, of Gospel Bluth. Yeah, because our buddy Don, he doesn't, how do I put this? It's not that he's hateful, it's just that he's flippant with how he portrays characters a lot of the times. There's a lot of color coding. There's a lot of like weird little things in his characterizations and his animations and in his stories. And it's, I'm so glad I built this entire series around this man.
You wouldn't expect that like first thought, best thought is like a good approach to like animation, which is like historically like a very complex and like long-term project. And here we are. Like,
Yeah. I think these things through.
But critical with the introduction of Tech 2 is the introduction of the concept that there are aliens in this world. There are like humanoid aliens with celebrity voices, and we're going to meet a lot of them to come.
And that to me, I mean, the fact that Tech is like on Earth, that I was kind of wondering, like, why do we not understand the dredge when they talk? But for some reason, like every other far-flung species is like totally like, yeah, you know, communicable. And I was wondering if it's like these creatures all kind of like inhabit the same planet at that age? Like, is there any like kind of backstory on that like we're aware of?
Not that we are aware of that is introduced in the movie. There were three novelizations of Titan AE: Kale's story, Akima's story, and Sam's story, because we gotta know what happened to Sam Tucker, aka Ron Perlman, aka Kale's papa. And Akima's story and Kale's story end when the movie begins. So in theory, like, those novels provide more of a backstory to, like, what's going on in this universe? Why are there so many aliens here? Why is Kale the way he is? Because
they really thought they had something here.
They really did.
Those books, of course, from the universe of Titan E. As it's not AE yet.
True.
Do they ever explain that AE stands for After Earth?
Not until the end of the movie. Nope. Great. When it pops up on screen and it says, like 16 AE in parentheses, After Earth. It's like,
yeah.
Oh, that's what it is.
Hey.
Titan A.
Two tickets for Titan A.
I also appreciate that. In the 16 years since the formation of, spoiler alerts, of Planet Bob, why have the characters not aged at all? Like, I know we're hopping around the timeline here, but it's just like, they could have put a little salt and pepper on the sideburns there. They look exactly the same.
Like, I'm wondering too, like, did the new Earth form, like, immediately? Like, did it take 16 years for the new Earth to form, or did it take like moments and that's why like they don't age? I mean that part wasn't clear to me. I don't know.
But then 15 years after 3028, we're in 3043, and we know that the bands Lit and Power Man 5000 exist.
Yep.
In space, we've got a great Glenn Ballard produced soundtrack, and we meet a lot more fun celebrity voiced alien friends. There's a Goon, the John Leguizamo Turtle Man, very fun,
very good,
killing it in a supporting role as Leguizamo always does,
killing it. And Nathan Lane too is Preed. I mean, eating this roll up, absolutely killing it.
The boldness of the choice to make John Leguizamo a turtle and Nathan Lane a big, lanky, sort of bat kangaroo man is just like, we're really turning that Disney thing right on its ear again, you know? Like, you know, whereas, you know, in a Disney movie, the Nathan Lane character would kind of look like Nathan Lane a little bit. It would sort of be like, yeah.
Yeah. I also like how we're never really sure if like Goon is a pet or like a guy, because they kind of treat him as a pet sometimes. They like pat him on the head, and then sometimes he's doing work and I'm like, I don't know if you're just being like condescending because he's a little turtle man, or if he's like, or if you have to feed him and like take him out for walks.
We're skipping over the Janine Garofalo kangaroos, yes, too.
Oh, the
kangaroo with a very wide stance, sort of scuttling like a crab the whole time. Like,
what was the design like discussion for that? It's like, well, we got a kangaroo lady. Great. How are we going to make her different? Let's give her.
She's in a permanent really squat.
she's just squatting for her entire life. Also, her like gait is 20 feet long.
It does feel like, though, the Nathan Lane character and the Janine Garofalo character and the characters who are on the name escapes me, the testicle hydrogen planet.
I too wrote Dogfight on Testicle Planet Gave Me a Headache is in my notes. Dogfight on Testicle Planet Gave Me a Headache.
I'm glad we both went there. Some like type shit.
I would read Dogfight on Testicle Planet. It sounds like a pulp novel.
Like, they all kind of had this similar, like, you know, Anastasia-y, like, kind of pointy-eared, like, they all had that vibe about them. It all kind of looked like they had kind of mutated from the same crop. And then John Leguizamo is out here looking like Franklin, and it's a completely different body type. And it just,
yeah,
it's, I kind of thought that they were going for a consistent look for, you know, the majority of these kind of like non-human characters, even like the, you know, guard who is not allowing them through to like the slave trade or whatever, even still has that kind of look. So it was like, yeah, he came up with two really good ideas and then just decided to go with one for like 75% of the people in the extended universe.
Yeah. Like, this was a lot of the aliens who weren't Preed or Janine Garofalo Kangaroo, whose name I'm forgetting.
Stiff.
Stiff, that's right. Stiff. Great.
Stiff. Rolls right up the tongue.
Silly
movie. That's important because the animated movies are really don't rely on diction, so it's you know, it's a good thing.
Oh god, god, god. Yeah. It, like, I feel like most of the aliens that weren't Stith or Preed were recycled from like Troll in Central Park and what those, like, what the evil trolls looked like. And a lot of the humans were probably recycled from other Bluth movies. I mean, this was like pretty much right off the heels of Anastasia, of Bartok the Magnificent. Don Bluth only knows how to draw one type of guy, which is why Kale looks exactly like Dimitri, who looks exactly like Prince Cornelius, who, like, he's one of the most influential animators of all time, and yet a lot of his designs are the exact same.
So what does it say about me that my two favorite visual moments in this entire movie were not a Don Bluth joint? Namely, the Wake Angels and the Ice Field. And I'm sure we'll get into both of those. But, like, you get into the credits and it's literally, like, Reality Check Productions. And it's like, oh, cool. Okay, so, like, he didn't make the good-looking stuff. He just, you know, made the archetypes.
Yeah.
The you said these two action set pieces were so compelling. I can't believe we haven't mentioned the fact that this whole movie is a mix of traditional hand-drawn cell animation and computer-generated animation, like, you know, CGI backgrounds and ships and that sort of thing. Which I also think, you know, you're joking about Janine Garofalo, Janina Roo's you know, wide gait. But I think it's because, like, they're kind of just like sliding all over the background. They were not like, they were probably, these cells were likely drawn in a void and then like placed into a digital background, of which this is certainly Don's first time playing with this technology.
Yeah.
Well, I guess there's some in Anastasia. There's some digital backgrounds in Anastasia, but like, you know, St. Petersburg Square and that sort of thing. But like, there's a couple moments of jarring, like, inconsistency of scale and just like, what is the traction of the earth beneath, you know what I mean? But, yeah, you kind of like sliding in place and that sort of thing.
Every time the camera pivots, the frame dips to like 4 frames a second, and it's just like this weird kind of like stuttery, like, rotoscopy effect, which, like, almost looks cool by accident.
Yeah.
It's really, I mean, like, it's, I've always associated this like 2D 3D kind of thing with like
Futurama.
I know they're first to do it, but I think they do it in a way that looks really seamless and natural.
Yeah, Futurama, and like, looks, I don't think this, though.
I don't think this is a bad looking movie, but I think this is a movie that the tech has not aged in the way that they probably hoped it would in the year 30, 20, whatever, you know?
Just to reiterate an earlier point, Dogfight on Testicle Planet gave me a headache. It gave me a fucking headache to look at. Because, like, you have no sense of who's in what ship, what the fucking sense of geography is, where we're going. There's just a lot of stuttering movement on screen.
Yeah, no, that was a dizzying part of the movie. Like, Do I love the Gal? Yes. I think those were the coolest looking aliens. They're just bat birds and they don't really talk. They just kind of like motion. So it's like, oh, they're very like mystical. Yeah. The like hand up to the moon. Was
great,
like,
great for a podcast.
Yeah, I hope everyone could see us doing it.
Just imagine, you'll get it. It'll be fine.
But like, they look really cool, and their planet, like the buildings, do look like they would be painted on the side of a van in 1983. That very kind of like airbrushed, like metal, death metal looking, like. Edge Geiger. Like pointy edges, yeah, like it's Geiger, exactly, thank you. Very like intense looking, and then you have these like very cool looking aliens, but then to like culminate this like very interesting, or to like set this really interesting like scene and have it like end with the worst fight that doesn't seem to have an end, that doesn't like seem to have like a begin. It's just like it just happens, and
yes,
people are like being tossed around in the air and things are blown up and there are like no real consequences. Something I noticed about like that scene in particular was like how the Dredge, just like them showing up, is exhausting because they are indestructible by all accounts. They're made out of like pure energy. So when they show up, it's like, God fucking damn it. These guys, like, not even that they're going to kill us. It's just like, we can't beat that. Like, there's going to be no end to this because they can't beat them. They should just give up.
That would have been a good, you know, if they kind of did like an about face and they just turned to the camera and said, well, that's the movie. And they like, guys, I mean, we can't do it. Like, what do you want from us?
No,
simply not possible.
So we haven't touched on Kale's ring yet, and Kale has has basically the Shia LaBeouf glasses from Transformers. He has a map hidden in something that he wears that his father gave him.
Yeah.
But so, they don't know they a map to what is the question?
Well, it's so great because like no one like it's like so clear to him right away. Like there's no like, oh, but why do I have this? Why was this given to, like, why is this so important? It's just like, nope, exposition. This is for you. And it's your father's. And so for the listener, if you've not seen the film, which is fine, you're not missing out.
You didn't want to pay $919 for LaserDisc like some guy on Reddit.
Did someone
us Titan heads call it TAE. We just shorten it to TAE. It's sort of, you know, if you're a real Titan head like us.
Hey, remember the Titans, right?
I'm so upset.
That's basically Kale's character description this whole movie. Remember the Titans.
But he doesn't want to remember the Titans because he hates his dad for leaving him, because his dad left him on Earth and gave him a ring and was like, I want you to have this, remember me, I'll see you again. And then spoiler alert, doesn't ever see him again because he dies. We don't know how, he just dies, but we don't see it happen. He just never gets back to Kale. So that's why Kale grows up in this like drifter colony where he's like a scavenger, like a tech scavenger or something like that.
But he's kind of got like a space sea dude, so like that's working out for him. Yeah. You know? Like,
I also really like that he painted the number one on his little like space scooter.
Yeah, that's how you know he's the main character.
Yeah,
because he's, yeah, that's just so the other guys, just so the other guys in the Drifter colony know that I'm gonna be like the main character here.
Also. We did not even touch upon one of the other celebrities I'm going to say celebrities in quotes, I think, but who we meet in that first Drifter colony, the chef, the cockroach, played by none other than Jim Brewer. So,
oh yeah,
very fitting for him to be playing a fucking cockroach. But
One of two SNL cast members in the, because we also got Charles Rocket.
Rocket, yeah. Saw that in the credits.
Yeah.
Good to see.
Yeah.
Rocket and Brewer?
And
together at last. Rocket.
Little on the nose, am I right?
That's Charles Rocket. Yeah, yeah.
Do you think Don saw his name?
Hey, Rocket, that's kind of cool, yeah.
That's kind of like
give me Tommy Blastoff too.
What? Tommy Blastoff? No- yeah. Okay. We got one Rocket, that's cool. The kids like that, right? Yeah, real spacey. Yeah. He's terrible. After Kale, like the Dredge come into the Drifter colony and Kale escapes and he's reunited with Akima, played by Drew Barrymore. And
this is where the collar pull should have come.
Yeah, the real collar pull.
Akima Kunimoto.
Played by Drew Barrymore.
Yeah.
Folks.
Yeah.
Yep.
They had solved racism in the year 2000. It's kind of incredible.
She's just a girl boss, you know? And
so, yeah, she looks like Wild Style from the Lego movie, because that's how every fucking girl looks in every one of these movies.
And a Shego from Kim Possible.
Yes.
Like, yeah.
That archetype of just, like, I have dyed hair only in the front. Mm-hmm. And, like, I could kick your ass, but, like, really, I just want a man.
She's like the Ramona. Fine. Yeah, she's just, like, the Ramona Flowers of space. She's like supposed to be this tough girl, and she's very much just like another damsel in distress, with the facade of being like this like tough, like empowered, like female character. She's got the dyed hair, that's kind of alt. She's wearing a vest, that's kind of cool. Like,
she's got the shower scene in a kid's movie.
And make no mistake, we do see ass in this movie. Don Bluth sat down an animated booty, which is a first, I hope. But
this movie is so acutely for 12-year-old boys. Like, it's like, it's not even teens, and like there's one magical like summer sleepover where this is a night movie, and it happens like between 7th and 8th grade, I think. Like,
it was the summer that changed our lives and made us better people. I think that's a really good point, because like most of the soundtrack is, I mean, Creed was like the song in the trailer, and then
Higher
was not in the movie. Higher was just in the soundtrack. But I'm so glad we're listening to nu metal and the like in the year 3048.
A classic Harvey Danger disturbing behavior scenario. I remember everyone was pissed off that Flagpole Sitta wasn't in the movie Disturbing Behavior, but was in all the trailers, because it was like, hey, that song's really hot right now, and this movie is out right now. Why isn't it in the movie? Back in the days when you would go to a movie to hear a song.
There was one track during the Wake Angel scene. Did any of you catch the lyrics to this song out of curiosity?
No.
It's my time to fly. It's my time to fly. My father will be with me tonight. Like, did they write this song directly for the movie? And if not, like, who the fuck, like, why does this exist? I didn't go through and kind of track each song to each scene, so I don't know who this was, but like, my jaw was on the floor. This was like truly spectacular sound painting, in my opinion.
I really want to hope it was coincidence, but I would not be surprised if they sat down and wrote.
Well, now, is this song from or music from and inspired by?
Yeah.
You know when a movie has a, you know when a musician is so inspired by the blockbuster film they just watched to just pen a song and say, hey, want this soundtrack?
Little Chad Kroeger hero energy, perhaps.
Yes. I do also just want to read a few of the names of the bands on the soundtrack, the artists on the soundtrack. We do have The Urge with It's My Turn to Fly. And then Jamiroquai. Everybody's Going to the Moon. Luscious Jackson.
Legally, they had to be on every movie soundtrack between like 1998 and 2002.
It had to happen. We also have The Wailing Souls. And Fun Loving Criminals. Yeah, it's a powerful, powerful soundtrack featuring rock, rap rock, alternative rap. You name it, it's got it.
I do just want to point out for the listeners at home that as of the taping of this episode, there is a there's an audio cassette of the soundtrack on Amazon for
$74.98.
Oh, hell yeah. Hop on. This is my new hobby, is just like finding the Titan AE like swag and merch and like seeing what it, you know, the secondhand market is like remarkable, because by all accounts, like, this shit should not be worth anything. Like,
no, it should
this
be
is very much like, yeah, like, yeah. You know, you get this at like the Middlebrook, you know, Galleria in like Ocean Township, New Jersey, yes. After seeing this at like a, you know, a movie birthday where you get pizza from a local joint and like, you know, everyone hands out like, you know, the little kind of like Kenner action figures or whatever, and like they immediately go in the garbage because no kid wants to watch this movie again, or they want to watch it again 75,000 times.
Yeah.
So it's like, that's kind of the balance that I'm trying to find here, you know.
Guys, can I read you something here?
Please. Please.
This is a 5-star review of the soundtrack from Amazon. And it's pretty good. It's a little long, so I don't think I'm going to do the whole thing, but I just love how this starts. When purchasing a movie soundtrack, most people choose music-oriented movies like Grease or Dirty Dancing, and you get what you expect. For a futuristic action movie, this soundtrack is amazing. Not only does it capture the feel of the motion picture, it has continuity and sound that is incredible considering the diversity of the artist producing the music. As an animated feature film, Titan A.E. has developed into a cult classic, and in the genre of science fiction, its storyline is strong and right up there with live-action, non-animated movies. As far as the soundtrack is concerned, the songs on the soundtrack are good enough to stand on its own. That is to say, this CD could be played for someone that has never seen the film, and they would be thoroughly entertained, 3 exclamation points. Wow. I'm not saying that the music on the soundtrack tells the story of Titan A.E.
No.
I'm saying that every song on the soundtrack is worthy of hearing. I do think a variety of music on the CD runs the gambit from pop rock, soul, reggae, rock, to progressive, alternative rock, but all manages to retain a continuity that makes this quote-unquote soundtrack sound more like a concept album than a collection of hits from various artists.
Wow.
It goes on, but damn.
That is a way better review than Sarah, who bought this CD on September 8th, 2015. Taste was a little worse for the wear. It had been soaked in water and a little sun faded, but the CD was great and it's fine. So there's that.
Wow. These reviews are all over the place. This is great.
You got a soaking wet CD of alternative rap.
Oh.
I gotta give you this one. This is another 5-star. Great soundtrack. Great soundtrack. Good reminder of the film. Quite a few songs for the album includes 4 main ones. The song from the scrapyard, Rebuilding Ship, Flying Through Plasma, and End. 5-star. And.
Amazon Costumer writes, it is what it is. There's only 4 sings on here that I actually like, but I still think it's worth it to get those 4. I like the idea in the year 2017, you couldn't locate these 4 songs independently of actually going to buy this CD.
Ray, this is what someone's saying, my favorite track, It's My Turn to Fly by The Urge, parentheses, when he is piloting the spaceship along with the Space Angels, is on here, and it is not available on either iTunes or Amazon MP3.
What?
So for all you Urge fans, I suggest you check this album out.
That being said, if I may, I do have to get this in here.
I'll allow it.
Steel Wing 13 was not very happy He really wanted was the scratch one, and he couldn't get this disc any other way. It was really annoying, and two people found that helpful.
Well, I'm glad two people found that helpful. I'm really sorry to steal wings.
I also see user max311 at excite.com says, this CD is just plain bad. The lit song is the only good thing on it. I couldn't believe they took off 311's Bomb the Town. I'd love the CD if they hadn't done that.
You know what you could do to fix that? You upload the CD and then you just buy the other song and then put it in there and pretend it was always a part of it.
Damn.
Wow. I am so thankful.
So the music is just
So the music is a hit.
It's just
is
what great.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
I do think that Cale would have been at the last Woodstock and would have been one of the people setting the fires. He would have been
racing away in a little cart with a number one spray painted on the side. It would all be full circle.
His hand is the schedule for the first day.
I'm pretty sure most of the bands on this soundtrack actually played at Woodstock 99.
Yeah.
Wouldn't be shocked.
Oh boy.
Wouldn't be shocked. So right. we were talking about the music.
We were in the scrapyard. We were in the salvage yard. We were, you know.
Yeah,
we found the map.
Mm-hmm. Are you sure we weren't on a trade ship Soros? That really hits different.
Something that's so funny too. So, like the opening credits of this movie, it's like, all right, here's John August, Ben Edlund, and Joss Whedon, and every one of these people had a different draft of this movie. And so, like, John August is such, like, I don't know, I feel like he has like a reputation as such, like kind of like a meat and potatoes story craft sort of writer.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have separately I think with the exception of Ben Edlund, who's like, I think like satire has like leaned, I don't know, I guess you're still like playing with the same like tropes and stuff, but it's like, I feel like these are three guys who all think they fucking are the first person to like acknowledge that like Joseph Campbell exists, and all think like they've invented like some like Dan Harmon story wheel thing. And so like, when you have one person write that script and then have another one of those fucking guys rewrite it and have another one of those fucking guys rewrite it, it starts to become, it's like we're satirizing things, but then playing some straight that are like, we're hewing to these tropes, but then trying to subvert, and it's just kind of become soup.
Yeah. There were so many parts of it that did feel like it was supposed to be like, oh yeah, now they're running into this kind of character again. Like Bill Pullman's whole character is just like the, oh yeah, kid. You know, when I was a young man, like his whole character is just far from Spaceballs. He's replaying that character, but like every sci-fi movie, there has to be like some tough guy who's in charge. Who has to end every sentence with kid, and you know that he's like washed up and tough because he's wearing like a button-down shirt with like a retro print and like a bomber jacket, and he's got an alt-right haircut. Like that's how you can tell this is the guy in charge, and he's tough, but he cares.
And it has a consistent tone, the movie, but like because it manifests itself in the action and like the weird, like too mature, but then like childish sexuality, the comedy, the like the slapstick violence, bookending like legitimate, like, oh no, now he's in trouble violence. Like,
yeah,
you never know what you're supposed to fucking care about, or like what like matters, or like what like,
yeah,
yeah, you kind of like, you keep like being like, all right, I'll hold on to this rung of the ladder to be invested in this, and it's like, oh, that's not a thing, all right, cool, yeah, cool. Well, let's try again. Yeah,
there were so many, like, it was like there were, how do I say this? It was like overly dramatic at points. Like it felt more like a soap opera than it did like an animated movie for like your 12-year-old cousin Charlie. Like it felt so like overdone. Like the part where like Akima and Kale are trapped in the Dredge spaceship and she's just like, okay, I'm gonna tell you my whole deal, and it's like so like so over dramatic, it's so over performed, it's unnecessary too. Like it doesn't like
or like to compare it to like something like, you know, like Star Wars, which like also has like a lot of different species of aliens and that sort of thing, and you might be or like it takes place like, you know, kind of has a very simple like, hey, hero's journey sort of story. The reason that like I think like clicks so well and simply with like an audience, like, you know, most people as a viewer or whatever, like whatever you fucking care about Star Wars, is that like George Lucas is such like a flat kind of like, I'm just gonna set this camera up and hit record, and like, you know, he's kind of like a flat director.
Yeah.
And Bluth is almost like too idiosyncratic. That like because like the human beings themselves are also squashing and stressed, like it sort of adds to like the I don't know, it adds to this it removes the humanity an extra degree, I think.
And Kale is not a likable protagonist either. He's
right,
not by a long shot.
He's not likable. It's like he's got a bad attitude. He's troubled. But he's also like deeply selfish and like cruel and like legit, so, like tells him like, yeah, I'll help you, but like what's in it for me to save humanity? Like
yeah, not that I've ever been in this scenario, but like if my dad had-
Okay, you guys remember when Earth blew up that time?
I can't speak for everyone, but you know, like if my dad handed me to a fucking alien and said, son, I have to go away for a while, I wouldn't be like, fuck you, dad. I'd be like, well, clearly, I mean, he has to go do something really important. And like, I shouldn't resent him for the next 15 years. Like, to me, it was so unbelievable that it's like, oh, you know, now it's time for me to be this brooding, surly teen and not just like, oh, like I lost my father and he was doing something for the greater good. Like,
yeah.
That's, come on, man, like, really?
Apparently in the novelization Titan A.E. Kale's story, it does reveal how Kale became resentful of his father's disappearance and how he came to despise the Drifter colonies. So again, if you read the book, then all of that is explained. But, I mean, I can't read.
But
so.
You gotta read all three.
It's a whole series, gang. But yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Like if like there's no justification that we know of where we're supposed to be like, yeah, no, that makes sense. Like, of course he'd be angry at his dad, but instead, like we're seeing the world just like burn around him. Ray, I think that's a great point. And I'm sorry that your dad gave you that ring.
And it was fucked up because it fit so perfectly on my 5-year-old finger. And then it just kind of like a tree trunk, it just kind of grew around my like adult finger. And I never took it off one time to realize that there were a bunch of dip switches on the inside. Like, didn't really think too much about it.
Also, I do just want to, going off about how Kale is wholly unlikable. He and Akima have like zero chemistry too. Like there's not like everything they, every interaction of them is like with them is speaking in things that they think are innuendos, but are just like,
yeah,
like that's the vibe I'm getting. It's like, oh yeah, you can open up the doors and go outside. It's like, just that's not hot. I don't, there's just zero chemistry there. And then to have like most of her dialogue be her shouting his name. Yeah. I don't know, folks. Speak on this.
It kind of it kind of just felt like, yeah, they were so horny that their stomachs hurt And they just channeled that into normal dialogue. And we were supposed to, as like 8-year olds, be like, oh, well, clearly they're just really sexually frustrated in space because none of the other aliens have like compatible genitals.
Right. Everyone else is like, wow, two of the same kind. You can, right.
You can do it.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah. They both have these like miserable orphan backstories. There's the stretches of their dialogue that feel like they're trying to one up one another with their like, you know, tragic beginnings and that sort of thing. And she'll say hers, and then he'll say his, and then she'll have this like, oh my God, Kale, I never knew that. Like, you know, moment. But, and
yeah, but like by all accounts, like, and again, we don't know her full backstory. You'll have to read Akima's story, which chronicles her life aboard Drifter colonies and also reveals where she learned her karate skills, which I didn't know she had. But...
Looking, can I read you the sections of her Wikipedia on this is the Titan After Earth Wiki, sponsored by the fandom wiki. All right, so under background, we have 1.1, early life. Followed by leaving New Marrakech, followed by encounter with Golbus and meeting Stith, followed by Faldro Flight Academy, followed by a daring escape, the Window Watcher, search for Titan, Flight of the Phoenix, final contact, final conflict. Spoiler alert, New Earth.
That's interesting that there's a New Marrakech, because in the movie there's a New Bangkok. So yeah. Like, I wonder if there are all these little outposts that just represent every like city on Earth just kind of hanging out. And like Titan is really unnecessary because they're all already out there. This is just kind of putting them in the same place.
Yeah, that would be an interesting concept to explore that this movie absolutely fucking didn't. You know, there was a moment when we were speaking, probably like 5-10 minutes ago, where I had said something, and I thought to myself, oh no, Dan, you're doing a bad job like describing this movie. And I don't think anyone could do a good job describing the plot of this movie. I like, it's like, because we're describing, like, well, there's stuff, and that's kind of how the movie presents itself. It introduces like new ships and new aliens, but it's like, okay, now what's happen, and who do the, what are these people's relationship to one another or anything? And then there's just another new ship and another new alien and another new stuttery dog fight.
Yeah, then, for minutes. Yeah, you're fine.
Yeah, awesome. It kind of feels like my older brother had these toys growing up. It was a line of Mattel toys called Captain Power. And Captain Power's thing was he had a ship. You could put the action figure in a ship, and you could buy a videotape. And basically, like, the ship would interact with the videotape kind of like a Duck Hunt gun, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, this ship and all the Captain Power action figures were lost to the sandbox well before I was of age to play with them. You know, they were gone, but we still had these VHS tapes at our house. And sure, you're a kid, you're bored. We didn't have cable at my house growing up. I'd be like, sure, I'll watch this tape. And it was kind of just like flight simulator footage with like flashes on it and that sort of thing. Like, you know, did like, but like space flight simulator footage. This watching Titan A made me think of watching one of those like game tapes without the toy.
Well, I mean, if you animated your own like cells and just held them up to the TV, that would effectively just be the
movie. Yes,
yeah. You could have bootlegged the whole movie.
You can make like, this all that we deserve.
Oh, boy. Okay, theories on whether or not this exists in the same continuity as Will and Jaden Smith's After Earth, directed by M. Night Shyamalan.
Oh. Well, okay, interesting point. Interesting mention, because this was supposed to be a live-action movie. Titan A.E. was supposed to be live action. If that was the case, it would have been like a grittier movie. They were considering Matthew Broderick and Jean-Claude Van Damme for the roles of Kale. For the role of Kale. So I feel like if it had gone down that route and had been a live action, I'd be like, yeah, I could see it being in the same vein as Will and his son bopping around the galaxy.
You know, and it's, even if it was live action, I still would have liked to see Matt Damon, because I think that, like, this could have had, like, pre-Born Identity kind of, like, I feel like he could have been, like, a leading action guy, right? Was Born Identity out yet? I don't know.
No, those were later in the 2000s. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
He hadn't done those yet, yeah.
Can you imagine the moment where Matt Damon got the script for a movie called Titan AE and thumbed through it and is like, you know what? Yeah, this is really speaking to me. Like, or was it just like a paycheck so big it'd make you shit your pants?
I think, like, most celebrity animation voiceovers, he probably did this on his fucking voice memos in the back of a car somewhere. not to be cynical, but...
Explains the great...
Matt Damon phoned it in?
Celebrity animated voiceover thing. I also confess that before rewatching this movie the other night, I had kind of mistaken what this movie was. I don't know why, but for some reason in my brain, I thought there was like a music. I mean, obviously, we discussed there is a music element, a very important music, but I guess I thought it was like a musical. I guess I like kind of conflated it with like rock and roll. In my brain, just because like Luth had done a bunch of animated stuff, you know, mm-hmm. or like musical stuff, you know. For some reason, I when I dove into this, I also thought, I didn't realize they were humanoids. I too thought they were like the humans were like anthropomorphic rat people or something like that, and I was incorrect about that.
I mean, most of Don Bluth's movies
are about singing rat people, right?
Yeah, most of his movies are musicals. Except for this one, Secret of Nim, and Land Before Time. So,
sure.
Land Before Time is a musical, isn't it?
No, the first one is not a musical. It's the 13 after that are all musicals.
Oh, my mistake. My brain is conflating all these movies into one, like, you know, the human condition sized epic.
The Odyssey of Land Before Time.
Well, how do you think Don's as our resident Bluth, what's your title? Are you like a P, like a
PHP,
like a yeah? Now that you're reaching the end of this filmography,
I would say PhD, PH Don,
PH Don. That's great.
Yeah.
So as the resident PH Don, how do you think his like? How do you think the faith thing factors into this movie, which is like, I feel like he's got that in a lot of his movies too.
He really does, and I think. Okay, let me think on this for a moment, because I think it's safe to say, because he didn't write this. He was directing it. Like, this comes across first as like a very godless movie. It's set in space. It's new. It's not like old timey. A child doesn't like, I guess there is a golden child, but he's not a child. He's a man. I would say, so
he's just acting like a child.
He's acting like a petulant child. I would say this is about like coming back home, but most importantly, returning to a belief system that you had let go of, that you lost. This is, you know, Kale, and I'm sorry, I cannot say the name Kale without a little voice in my head going, like the salad. But Kale, he is a non-believer. He has lost his faith. He's lost his faith in humanity, in family, in friends. And then over the course of this movie, he starts to be welcomed back into the arms of that faith, into that loving relationship of knowing what home is. And I think and in this essay I will talk about how Kale is a born again Christian coming back home, building a new life in the arms of a loving God and a faithful wife. So long story short, yeah, I think there's still some Christ aspects to this.
This might be preemptive. Is this your favorite Bluth?
No. No. here's the thing. Don, his first three movies, fantastic. His first three movies are, of course, Secret of Nim, American Tale, Land Before Time. Land Before Time has problems of its own in a lot of ways. And even though it is not the best film, critically speaking, I love it to death and I will stand by it. After that, it is all trash. As an authority figure on Bluth, I will stand by that. It is trash. It is absolute garbage. It is Rockadoodle, Troll in Central Park, which gave me a stomach ache and I had to take a break for a while. It is... I wish I was kidding. That movie was so bad. It was, I'm forgetting one, but there were, it was like the dark period of Don Bluth. And then his comeback was Anastasia. So when Anastasia happened, everyone was like, gotta have Don. Don's a man. Like when this movie was, when Titan A.E. was getting passed around from studio to studio, and it finally landed on Don's desk, and they were like, you're the guy to do it. Also, you have a little over a year to finish this entire fucking movie from scratch. Have fun. And that, I think, speaks to how, like, they saw him as, like, this really fantastic animator, someone who was, like, who had really high standing, who had maybe reclaimed that with Anastasia. But what they forgot was that he made some real shit movies and biffed it, and only, like, only two of his movies have been critically, like, well received and successful up until that point. So no, this is not my favorite, but it's not the worst one.
I guess I'm just like a little crestfallen to hear that, because this is the only movie that I'm aware of in the Bluthiverse that has a ship that contains the cum of every single species on Earth in like a vial that is like arranged perfect. Like that to me, like
that was Kale's dad's job.
You know,
Kale's dad roamed the Earth.
I need to stay behind, son. I need to jerk off the elephants.
You know, he was inspired by the woman who had a relationship with the dolphin.
I need to take LSD and give hand jobs to sea mammals. You don't understand. Goodbye, my boy. Here, take my ring.
It's got a
It'll lead you to where I keep the cum.
I'm not gonna need this ring. It'll probably chafe the animals a little too much.
Some of them have a nickel allergy.
Smooth palm.
I mean, one of the first vials that Akima pulls is the bottlenose dolphin one. So, just saying.
But why'd you taste it first? I mean, Jesus.
I was impressed by the butterfly.
Unmistaken, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
God, Ron Perlman was a sick fucker for that. Real sick.
The commitment to the bit that Ron had to be like,
the commitment.
This is my project. No pun intended. This is my pet project. I'll see myself out.
See you, right? I mean, like.
But also, like, when you're like terraforming a new planet that like you've made too, to be like, all right, step one, bobcats. We need to make lots of bobcats walking around. That's what, you know, humanity's been in the rough for a little while, but more large predatory animals.
Also, a planet terraformed by Blue Sky Studios, if you caught that in the credits,
ooh,
who would go on to make Ice Age.
Yeah.
So, Ice, I mean, If you can't tell, I'm just kind of skirting around, like, the one scene that makes this movie fucking watchable, in my opinion, is that goddamn
ice. You know what would have been a lot cooler about that scene, though? If Scrat from Ice Age was there.
Exactly!
Running along, where's that little ice shot with the nut. Yeah.
I love that little.
I mean, Leguizamo is already in the movie. Why didn't we have a little cameo?
Oh, yeah.
It's all connected, man.
Was a backdoor.
Once again, I said this at the top, constantly reminding you of other animated shit you wish you were watching instead.
I mean, I know this isn't animated, but the whole, like, finding the terraforming ship and all the vials of things, it did remind me of
the Titan. The titular Titan.
Thank you. I forgot its name. But it did remind me of A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where it's just like, yep, gonna press the button, start my new Earth, and now we have a new planet, and every living thing on Earth is, like, back, and we have dolphins and fish and all this shit. Which makes me think.
I did read that Bluth wanted to make a Hitchhiker's adaptation prior to the live action one.
Oh. Interesting.
So, I heard that he wanted to make a Beatles movie. Did you see this?
No, but I really want that to happen more than anything. If Yellow Submarine was a Don Bluth joint, I would lose my shit.
Like, you know, literally, it was inspired. Michael Jackson approached Don Bluth and was like, "Hey, you're the animator guy. Like, I want to make a Yellow Submarine type movie now that I own the catalog." And then Ringo was warning him with Peace and Love that he could not use his likeness. So there's, like, test footage floating around.
Do not use my likeness.
I'm warning you with peace and love. Peace and love.
Don Bluth, do not turn me into a sexy rat.
Donnie, baby. On July 7th. Take this as a warning. If you make my face on your animated film, there will be a gun drawn.
There is test footage of this. Can I find it, please?
Yeah, and here's the moment where Lily's going to insert the test footage. Wasn't that great?
Wow, everyone. What a treat. I'm so glad we shared this moment together.
That was fab.
That's right, Dan.
what fab footage.
Hey, speaking of the Beatles, you know what Kale said when he was in the Dredge jail? Help! Also, okay, maybe I need some explanations here. How the fuck did he get out of the jail? If you could just... He says you could just finger the jail cell and then it just opens?
Yeah.
Was it his ring?
Was it that fucking ring? It was static.
Like, was it like a key? I feel like at a certain point, the ring got, like, more power than they're like, yeah, it does that too.
Yeah, it started as a key, but then it's like, no, this makes you the most powerful organism in the entire universe.
Yeah, and then it could project. And,
yeah. it makes me think, like, if the Dredge are made of electricity and pure energy, wouldn't the easiest way to destroy them be splashing a little bit of water on them? Because maybe my knowledge of energy science, heat science, electricity, maybe it's not all there. But, like, I don't know. I play Pokemon, and I know that electricity Pokemon are usually defeated by water or ice.
Or, like, rubber or something. You know, it's like why you're supposed to wear stickers when you're doing electrical stuff, you know? Yeah.
Like, throw some rubber at them.
Is water a scarce resource once Earth is blown up? Because I know at the very beginning,
no more
they show him
floating
the toilet. But, like, the Earth itself is so fucking brown and, like, desiccated. So, like, maybe they just, like, that was the only stream on the planet, and now there's just no water anymore. So the Dredge thought of that. They like they called your bluff.
Right.
Mm.
Shit.
Maybe.
These are just more questions that we will never get answers to.
We were right to use the Dredge for gasoline. We were right to turn their body. Humans were right to eradicate them and turn their bodies into our energy source. That's what I think about the Dredge in my heart.
The Dredge are actually the Dredge are actually our new fossil fuels. That's what they are.
Yeah.
Did the Dredge become the Earth's core? I'm overthinking this. There's no reason for me to
instead
be...
of calling it. Do you think instead of calling it fracking on Planet Bob, they call it dredging?
Fuck.
Okay.
I see you.
You know what else? That other needle drop. I kept waiting for the song that never came. That fucking Goo Goo Dolls song from Treasure Planet. I kept waiting for that song to drop because I'm like, yeah, like that's the rousing thing I want to hear, and it never came because this isn't Treasure Planet.
No,
I thought it was. Another movie I thought this was before I watched it was Atlantis: The Lost Empire. Like, how is it possible that these three movies were allowed, like, legally to come out around the same time? It's just, like, they're completely indistinguishable from the poster, from the trailers. Like, it's just, like, a bunch of dudes zipping around on, like, space bikes. Like, it's just, like, I don't know.
Boys, 12-year-old boy. Like, I don't think that was the original intention of this particular movie. This is like found out its live action origins, but it's just like such a small window of like, you know, now like, you know, I think like the Marvel movies have like, you know, why would any individual genre pick come out when it can be something you can sell toys against? It's good for kids. It's good for grownups. Like it's a lot of stuff. It's like, you know, it's sort of like checks every quad, you know what I mean? It's like, it's sort of like entertainment everlasting gobstopper where it like checks like every box you could conceivably need, you know, like it feels like and largely because of people like Whedon and Ben Edlund at the helm, it feels like a nudge in that direction, you know what I mean, of like almost like it's in a way almost like predictive of sort of like how entertainment was going to feel in 20 years because of that, you know, like.
On the subject of this movie being ahead of its time, I would be remiss if we didn't bring up what this movie did to Fox Animation.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
What do you mean, like, killed it forever?
Like, they shut down 10 days after. Like, it wasn't even like us here. They literally, like, they saw the weekend box office, opening weekend office, and they're just like,
and we make no
fuck
more
cartoon
movies.
Nope.
It's like, we tried. That is like a theme with Don Bluth and like studios, in that like most like his own studio that he formed after he left Disney went bankrupt, and then during or before Land Before Time went into production, he moved his entire studio to Ireland because he didn't have to deal with unions. he didn't have to deal with his workforce unionizing. Mm-hmm. But pretty much like every studio since moving to like his own has either shut down or like he's had to outsource to private companies, like Penguin and the Pebble. That's the one I was forgetting. Penguin and the Pebble was partially like financed by a private investor, like corporation. Tommy Wiseau, God bless him. But like, it's fascinating to me because he's ruined so many lives with his work, just in terms of like people being like fired because of it. And oh no, Dan, what did you? Oh no.
I found some great fan art of Kale and Akima and their new baby all hanging out on a new Earth. Oh. I thought that would be really nice.
Thank God this is.
I thought that'd be some nice fan art to share.
Wow.
With the chat.
Look at them. They look like Neopets. This is beautiful.
Like the early, you remember the earliest iteration of Neopets were like they were still human. Mm-hmm. It kind of has that vibe.
It really does. Oh my gosh.
Nice.
The texture of the stone is really incredible, though. I will give them that. Looks really
Can I say something controversial? This looks like the first clothed drawing that this artist has ever done. This just feels so explicit.
It was M. Bragg. Kale birthed that baby.
Drop the link. There is also, I will say, not that I'm looking, but there is like a slight bulge in Kale's trousers.
Well, I was looking. If you look at the shadow on the knee, it is cut off perfectly so that if you kind of squint, you can imagine that his penis is like the entire length of his shin.
Lily, I regret to inform that you're gonna have to tweet this picture so people have it for reference. You're gonna have to tweet this.
Not a problem.
To the episode link.
No, okay, not great. A problem. Not a problem. Wow, what a joy. Yeah, one thing I do really love about watching these terrible movies is finding the deviant art that people make. There are some really great ones of a Thumbelina that are chilling, honestly.
Oh boy.
Chilling.
Let me guess. Lady Big Finger. Yeah.
Yeah. You're picking up what I'm putting down. So yeah, this movie destroyed Fox Animation. It ranked fifth on its opening weekend, ranked fifth behind Shaft, Gone in 60 Seconds, Big Mama's House, and Mission Impossible. After its opening weekend, it lost about 60% of its audience. And oof. Yeah. And it lost $100 million.
What's that rundown again?
For the movies it came
so
behind.
Mission Impossible, Big Mama's House.
Big Mama's House, Shaft, and Gone in 60 Seconds. And it did lose $100 million for 20th Century Fox. Wow.
Yeah, because it's like too fucked up and distressing for like little kids. And then you got to figure middle schooler or like who has like any semblance of what's going on is like, well, I'm going to try and go see either Gone in 60 Seconds or Big Mama's House, right? Like. Yeah. Or Mission Impossible, if you haven't seen it, you know what I mean? But, like, those are all PG-13, like, you know?
Yeah, and it does, like, feel like one of those movies that if you see once, you're good. Like, you never have to see it again. You kind of get it the first rundown. So I'm not shocked that it lost... I found numbers. I'm not surprised it lost over half of its audience. It did in the second weekend, it did average $1,346 from 1,346 from 2,775 theaters.
Whoa.
Per theater, or is that total?
Total.
So like six tickets sold to this thing.
Pretty much. So I also want to talk a little bit more about the production and its reception. It was nominated for a lot of different awards, but none of the big ones. It was nominated for an Annie Award, a Golden Reel, a Satellite, and a Saturn Award. And it lost all of them, except it did win Best Sound Editing. A Golden Reel for Best Sound Editing.
That's a throwaway.
Yeah.
I gotta say, like, if I came home with an Oscar and I told my parents it was for sound editing, like, they'd probably make me sleep in, like, the doghouse. I mean, no disrespect. Like, you know, I know we're a community of, like, sound people and production people and, you know, we're kind of in the behind the scenes, so to speak, but, like, come on.
Yeah.
That's dog shit.
Yeah.
And there's a Saturn Award for that?
There's a Golden Reel.
Golden Reel.
Oh, Golden Reel. Oh, my goodness. Well, excuse me. Excuse the famous award we're all familiar with. The
Come
Golden
on, Dad.
Reel.
Come
oh, there
on,
I
Dan.
Fucking impugn the Golden Reel.
Get your shit Let together, Chamberlain.
Yeah. They give those out in fucking Parade magazine. What the fuck is a Golden Reel?
You'll note that Drew Barrymore was nominated for an UFTA.
That's right.
That's no idea what that is.
That's the sound everybody made when they heard the name of her character.
There's yeah. literally there is not a hyperlink to this award. As far as Wikipedia nope. knows, no one has ever been nominated for this.
The OFTA award could have just been somebody deciding to. At like a top 10 list for all we know.
Oh, she lost to Eartha Kitt for Emperor's New Groove.
Oh, that's
which cool. like makes sense because that yeah. movie rocked.
Yeah, that movie again, better movie. So
different podcast.
Different podcast, better movie. So the story, Titan A.E.'s story, was what's his name? There he is. So the story for Titan A.E. Was created by Randall McCormick, who is best known for Speed 2, Cruise Control, Psycho Sushi, and Scorpion King 2, Rise of a Warrior. And one of the producers or writers of Titan A.E. is most known for Anaconda. This is Hans Bauer. Anacondas, The Hunt for the Blood Orchid, and Komodo. So reptile themed films mostly. And then this one. Big into reptiles, Hans Bauer.
Oh. Did you see at the very end of the credits, look out for the exciting new Titan A.E. video game.
Yes.
In stores fall 2000.
And it was Hell promptly yeah. canceled after.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's so apparently there were there's a dedicated community of like people who like dump ROMs online, and apparently like there is a playable demo of some of this game.
Oh my god.
And it looks really bad in its defense. So I highly recommend you seek that out. Shout out to the Unseen64 .net community, because they're really doing the good work of making sure that we had to see this monstrosity. But that's like, imagine the unearned confidence to be like, yeah, we know this movie's gonna be so good that we're literally advertising the fucking game.
That's,
and like
that did that with like Anastasia, and but the thing is like Anastasia was a hit, so like that made sense. So they were just riding on hubris. They were so like overly confident. They were like, yeah, the Space Boy's gonna sell games too. And then the movie was a flop. But also like Don Bluth has a history of making video games. So that makes sense to me that it would be like the next step for him would be to help develop this.
Yeah, I was gonna ask you about this. Are you doing a Dragon's Lair episode? Because that feels to me like it is its own place in the canon.
I would like to. I've watched playthroughs and it looks bonkers. Have either of you ever played it?
No, I'm not much of a video games person, but like I'm aware of what Dragon Lair is. I also know there've been like a couple false starts at making like a movie version of. There was supposed to be like a CG one a couple years ago. There was like I think a live action one with what's the name, Owen Wilson was like going to be the guy at some point.
That makes sense.
And it's like, but like it's kind of surprising in this I don't know, we're at least like a decade into this pretty fucking like craven IP strip mining thing. And yeah, it's surprising that even like a decade into that phenomena, like that still hasn't like, I mean, I'm sure he must own the right, either that, or, like, do you know if he owns the right or if it's like one of these like, well, it's whoever owns the ColecoVision catalog now or some shit like that.
I actually don't know off the top of my head. I'll have to look into that because he sold a lot of the rights to his like earlier movies, which is why there are so many sequels to An American Tale and Land Before Time. Like, none of the sequels are Don Bluth pictures. They, like...
It's really surprising. Like, what would he need the money for?
All of the failed studios that he put into bankruptcy. That's what. I also just want to point this out because I think it's very silly. Much like Anastasia, storytelling of Titan A.E. is much darker and edgier than Don Bluth and Gary Goldman's previous films. And the film was regularly compared to Japanese anime. And although Bluth and Goldman denied any influence by anime, they have acknowledged the comparison. I really wanted them to be like, yeah, no, we watched some.
Escaflowne and
Don Bluth, secret One Piece stan.
Yeah,
we like that Naruto. Good guy.
I guess with the exception of Drew's character, I don't really see the anime influence in this movie. But I also appreciate their matter of fact, like, just rejection of the premise of like, no. You're flattering, but you're incorrect. Do you have a Don ranking system? However many mouse tails or however many
I should.
How many vials of cum does this movie get?
Yeah, the ranking system is
our
movie. Entire
movies. Titans worth.
Hubba hubba.
I guess you could do like his little space scooters. Can you introduce this stuff and then you don't fucking do anything with it? The first thing is like, oh, cool, a space scooter. He runs 15 feet and then falls off and then you never use those cool things again.
The trailer would have indicated that like he would be on that thing for like 80 minutes of the 90 minute.
Yeah, I guarantee you there was a fucking toy of it.
Now I have to Google, was there a McDonald's tie-in planned for this movie? Because, I mean, this seems... Oh, there was a Burger King one.
Oh,
there you go.
Wow. Check this out. The Kids Meal wiki site says Titan A.E. 2000. Titan A.E. was a 2000 animated feature film turned into a Burger King Big Kids Meal toy series in that same year. And that's the whole article. There's no pictures. I wonder if this is like the video game that like every copy was like recalled in like the desert. Like, I wonder if there is of like Titan King toys somewhere. Now this is really peaked my... these look...
Did you find them?
Really? Well, I'm just astonished. I mean, they don't even look... those are from the movie Avatar. I was confused because they're blue.
Wow.
But Ray, they have dread-ish forms. They're just really poorly made.
Do we have anything else we need to add about this?
I think anyone who has listened this far into the episode is first and foremost a fucking saint. And second of all, it seemed like a bad job explaining what this movie is. We did as good a job. I did as good a job as anyone. It's Titan A.E. does a bad job of explaining itself. And that's kind of the onus of the movie, I think. But, you know, between the positive soundtrack reviews too and the Gold Reel Award for sound editing, I think clearly audio is what this movie brings to the table, like a high quality audio. Yeah. You know, it's again, just what you want out of a vibrant animated picture is, you know, well, the sound. Walk out saying, "Well, sound was good.
Was great.
sound was great.
Phenomenal." It's a love letter to people who hate movies.
Oh man, I am inclined to agree.
Another good thing for this movie would have been All Dads Go to Heaven.
This fucker hates his dad so much.
That's why he's just spinning the Power Man 5000. I mean, that's like what you listen to when you're mad at your dad.
True. Ultimately, this is a movie about an older teen boy who's horny as hell and hates his dad.
And doesn't get kissed.
And never gets kissed. Even at the end. Even at the end, they're like interrupted. Wow.
Wow.
Really makes you think.
Really make you think.
Really makes you think, can I get these 90 minutes back?
I've wasted so much time with Bluth movies that
I stand goon, the lad John Leguizamo Turtle Man. I'm a goon stand. I think yeah. Goon deserves his own Bardock spin-off. I think there needs to be like a Goon the Magnificent, you know. Like, give me more Goon. I want to meet Goon's family. I want to meet his like turtle swamp planet.
I need to know if he's a pet or a part of the team.
Right.
The crestfallen sigh that I let out next to my wife on the couch when I found out that Goon was in fact still alive.
Yeah.
That was a crushing moment for me because I was anti-Goon since the moment. According to my calculations, he's this genius and he can't even type the coordinates into his weird triangle projector until this like dumb teen comes along and does it for him. I just like, I don't know. I mean,
I like Goon because he's funny and has glasses.
Remind you of anyone?
he's also like quite literally the like god out of the machine, like last possible second when you think everything is fucked, he swoops in and saves the day with his little maniacal goon laugh.
Yeah.
Oh boy. Yeah. Wow. I think we did it. I think I can finally say goodbye to Don Bluth.
You can finally sleep.
I can finally sleep.
Don Voyage.
Mr. Bluth. Oh shit, that's good. I am worried that when this podcast ends, he will die. And this was the one thing keeping him alive. But
I think you owe it to Don to keep him alive for another couple months.
No, Dan, let me fucking end this. You're missing the point of the episode.
I need it to die. Ray, I need it to die.
You are missing the fucking point.
Free me. Free me.
This can be used in a court of law against you. I'm trying to give you a way out here.
Yeah, I stand by what I said. Take me to jail or take me to church. Any final thoughts? This is the point of the episode where things start to fall apart generally.
I want to make a soundtrack inspired by the soundtrack inspired by the movie.
In many ways, I'm feeling like the opposite of Dredge in that they are pure energy and I am, after this film, no longer pure energy.
You know what? It's so interesting to me how most of my podcast guests have come out of watching these films angry and devoid of life. And I'm wondering, is that a Bluth problem or is that a me problem? So, in any case, I hope that you will both forgive me for this. But I can't thank you enough for being a part of this wretched series. You got any plugs to share, Dan, Ray? Any plugs?
Boy, watch the Tonight Show starring Jimmy Fallon every 11:35 night on NBC. Do shows around Brooklyn, that sort of thing. And what do you guys think? Twitter really going away? No, now we have it on the podcast.
Let's get into it.
Should I even drop the handles?
Who do you think is responding? Who do you think on the cast is responding to Elon's tweets about what to do with Twitter. Who do you like? You think Kale is fully like, yes, Elon.
Elon wants to live in Titan AE. Titan AE is Elon Musk's favorite movie. Elon, it is what he wants the world to
Elon
be.
Elon Musk wants to jerk off every animal on the planet and put it in a giant ball.
He wants the dredge to power his bad ideas. And
the dredge were born Titan from AE Tesla.
Is Elon Musk's favorite movie. Yeah, yeah.
Great.
That sounds like a sequel waiting to happen. There's some Tesla fucking, you know, intrigue going on there for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah, everyone watch the Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon. featuring our own Dan Chamberlain. Yeah. It's wonderful stuff. But you're wonderful, and I am so thankful that you were here tonight to chat about this. Ray, do you have a plug for the people?
Sure, yeah. I have an album called Life at Dusk. It's real Brian Eno / Stars of the Lid type shit, if you're into that. If you send me a photo that you've taken of Don Bluth without his consent or knowledge, I will send you a free copy. So slide into the DMs. Let's make it happen.
He's living in Utah, baby.
Thank you for taking us higher. It's been a real trip through space and time.
Wow. I can't, you know, it feels so strange to be wrapping up my series on my character study of Don Bluth, but thank you all for listening over the years. What started off as a pandemic obsession has become a full regret, and it's been wonderful spending every moment with you all. Dan, Ray, thank you so much for joining me tonight to chat about Titan AE. You're the heroes. You're the real heroes. folks, thanks for listening. I forgot how to sign off. Folks, thanks for listening. You're wonderful. And I'll see you one day somewhere out there.
This has been The Gospel Bluth. Thank you for listening. The song parodied at the top of the episode was by Crash Test Dummies. Please don't sue me, I don't make any money off of these episodes. Special thanks to my guests Ray Chalmay and Dan Chamberlain, who's all my guests for years. You're the real heroes. Thanks for sticking around, y'all. Have a good one.